Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Foate, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Carl Bernstein, who reads from and discusses his new book, A Woman in Charge, The Life of Hillary Rodham Clinton, published by Knopf. In the weeks to come, we have Richard Russo, Mary Carwile, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support. In the early 1970s, Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward broke the Watergate story for the Washington Post and set the standard for modern investigative reporting. Since leaving the Washington Post, Mr. Bernstein has written for Vanity Fair, where he is also a contributing editor, USA Today, Time, Rolling Stone, and The New Republic. He has also been the Washington Bureau Chief and a senior correspondent for ABC News. He's been honored with many awards, including the Pulitzer Prize Award, the Pulitzer Prize awarded to the Washington Post for its Watergate coverage. His books have been critically acclaimed as well as popularly received, and we're delighted that Carl Bernstein is with us tonight to present his latest, A Woman in Charge. Would you please join me in making Carl feel welcome?
Thank you all. Thank you. Thank you. Well, I guess you're the non-baseball fans. I don't know. Well, it's great to be here, and I'm glad you're here. And I'd like to talk a little bit about Hillary Clinton, about this book, and then answer very informally whatever questions you might have. Obviously, we need a real biography of Hillary Clinton. She stands perhaps at the threshold of nomination as the Democratic candidate for President of the United States. She may well be the next president of the United States. She's the most famous woman in the world, unquestionably. And yet, she's a mystery. And what is well known about Hillary Clinton tends to be caricature, the result primarily of misinformation and disinformation that has been promulgated over the years by her enemies, by her opponents on the one hand, by her acolytes and true believers on the other hand. And yet there has been very little in the way of comprehensive attempts to look at the reality of her life, unless it's been done either from animus or hagiography. So what I've done here, and I worked on this book for some 7.5 years, is to attempt what good journalism, good biography, good history really is, which is the best obtainable version of the truth. And that's a far different enterprise than most of what we have seen about Hillary Clinton. First of all, why I decided to do this book and when I decided to do it, which was right after the impeachment of Bill Clinton and his acquittal by the Senate of the United States, it occurred to me that the only person whose stature was enhanced by what had happened in the impeachment and the Lewinsky ugliness was Hillary Clinton. Everybody else involved had been diminished horribly. Bill Clinton, the Supreme Court of the United States, which in an outrageous decision allowed the Paula Jones case to go forward, holding that a sitting president of the United States could be subject to a civil suit, as if he had time to give his attention to that, and it couldn't wait until he had finished his term. The press, the Republicans in Congress, particularly those who initiated the impeachment, most of whom, many of whom, are no longer in Congress, having left because of their own sexual hypocrisy. And yet here was Hillary Clinton, who in the first 5 years of the Clinton presidency had really become damaged goods, had come into the White House with great hope, with great acclaim, with great portfolio, the health care portfolio to bring health care to the American, universal health care to the American people for the first time in our history, a goal that had eluded all Democrats since Franklin Roosevelt had first sought it. And yet, by the time her husband was impeached, she had been through not only the failure of health care, which in turn had really been what led, along with the perceived ethical pall that hung over the first couple of years of the Clinton presidency, which was largely attributable to matters involving Hillary more than Bill. But the failure of health care and those ethical questions really led to the election of the Newt Gingrich Congress of 1994, which was a tectonic shift in American politics, which for the first time since Roosevelt really meant that Democratic Party's dominance of Congress was over. And, of course, we have seen up until this past election the dominance of that Republican right-wing majority and its effect. So Hillary Clinton was deeply damaged by those events. She had seen her closest friend, former law partner, Vince Foster, commit suicide. Not literally saw him, but had in the 6 months of the Clinton presidency, something that she attributed to a murderous political climate and particularly a murderous press in Washington. After the Gingrich Congress had been elected, she chose to exile herself, really, from Washington most of the time, from the United States a good deal of the time, as she went and sought solidarity with women of the third world, and to great effect, and had some success in reconnecting herself with good works that succeeded. But by the time of the impeachment, as an indication of how low she had fallen in terms of the White House itself, by the time of the 1996 re-election of Bill Clinton, she was only able to campaign for him before friendly, essentially captive audiences, because otherwise she was thought to be a drag on the Democratic ticket. And yet, after the Lewinsky ugliness, in which she unquestionably had saved her husband's presidency, first in the first week after which the reports of Monica Lewinsky's involvement with her husband broke, she went on the Today Show and said she was certain that her husband had not had an affair with Lewinsky. And Bill Clinton, as I say in the book, had told a friend whom I talked to in the first hours after the story broke that he wasn't sure if he could survive the week in office, that there might be a cascade of Democratic Party demands that he leave office for this purported affair with a young intern. And yet, out of all this, Hillary Clinton, on the day and hour that Bill Clinton was being judged by the U.S. Senate, was meeting, while the votes were being cast for and against his conviction of high crimes and misdemeanors in the Senate. She was meeting upstairs in the White House with a view from the room she was meeting in of the Capitol beyond across the mall with her political Svengali Harold Hickeys, with maps of New York State spread out before them, considering whether to run for the Senate, that same body down the street where her husband was being judged, to join that body of senators in a race that most political pros deemed impossible. Someone who had never run for public office before, a First Lady of the United States, who had taken awfully hard knocks and almost been indicted in the so-called Whitewater matter, running for the Senate, clearly to redeem her own legacy, the squandered legacy that, as she had put it, that she thought Bill Clinton had thrown away by his recklessness. And she did it. And I had known about that meeting with Hickeys, and I had known that it took place, and the scene is set in the book, that it had taken place exactly while the votes were being counted, and the Chief Justice, with his self-designed robes, was presiding. He had designed them with a gold flourish after appropriately a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta. And one of the things you'll see in these pages of this book is the animus of William Rehnquist toward the Clintons. And fairly convincingly, I think that you can argue that Ken Starr was the choice of the Chief Justice, really, to be the special prosecutor, because it was the Chief Justice who named the panel, the special panel, as it was called, of U.S. Court of Appeals judges, who chose Ken Starr to be the special prosecutor, despite obvious conflicts of interest in, among other things, being part of a law firm that represented, that had filed, had wanted to file a brief on behalf of Paula Jones, a conflict of interest greater even than, certainly, than Hillary Clinton had been accused of. So his animus comes through the pages of this book. But more importantly, what this book is a coherent narrative and repertorial journey through the real life as lived by Hillary Clinton. And that hasn't existed before because of this previous body of misinformation and disinformation that I needed to sift through and then go to the people who knew her best. So I interviewed, over the course of the next 7 years, a couple hundred people, most of them, or many of them, several times, and most of them on the record. The most remarkable revelations in the book usually are attached to quotations from people who were there as witnesses. But what you get is a wholly different picture of this woman who is the most famous woman in the world, but as she herself says, I'm a mystery. Well, she's also a mystery partly by her own choosing, because she's very guarded, she's very private, she's very camouflaged at times. And from childhood, what you begin to see is a life in which there are regularly really horrible hurts, humiliations, embarrassments, and secrets that are about keeping those hurts and humiliations private and not becoming public. But the first thing I was told, I went to a mutual, and I have many friends in common with the Clintons, and I went to one of them before I started on the book, and this person who had been central to the campaign of 1992 and 1996 said to me, you know, you really have, if you're going to do a book on Hillary Clinton, you have to really begin with her Methodism. It's key to everything. And I said, what? And I knew she was Methodist. But it turns out that religion and family really are the foundations upon which her life has been built and have been the most important aspects of her life, family, religion, since she was a child. And her childhood, as David Broder wrote, one of the things that's been so satisfying about this book is the reviews. You take a look at my website, they're up there, carlbernstein.com, as well as some other pieces I've written about the Bush and Nixon administrations for Vanity Fair. But what all the reviews stress is that this book is judicious, balanced, fair, and generally the reviewers seem to think it's empathic. Some use the word sympathetic, but obviously there are things in there that make the Clintons uncomfortable. And I ran into Hillary day before yesterday, for the first time since the book came out in Des Moines. And I literally happened to be seated where, when she came into the room, and literally she kind of had to almost bump into me. And I said, hi, I'm your advance man. And Hillary said, oh, Carl. And put her arm around me, and we had a nice chat. And I said, you know, we ought to sit down and talk. And she said, let's get together in Washington or New York. Because she had said through the years of my working on the book, as had Bill Clinton, that she would talk to me for the book. And she kept putting it off and putting it off. And then as she was running, it was clear she was running for president. She and Bill Clinton, through an aide, said they would not talk to me for the book. And the ostensible reason was that there were other books being written about her, and they didn't want to favor one or the other, which I had serious doubts about. That was really the reason. And indeed, I knew from within the campaign that there had been a meeting with Bill and Hillary and their lawyer and some of the senior members of the campaign staff, and a decision was made that there were these aspects of the real story that they didn't want to be in a position to have to confirm that are uncomfortable. But that's the nature of the best obtainable version of the truth. And what my job is to be a responsible biographer, journalist, reporter. And what you get, though, is this incredible tale of this remarkable life and of a person who is far more compelling than her own telling of her story, because she's airbrushed so much of it that she's dull. And when the reviews came out, or when the first newspaper stories were written, I think there was a lot of attention paid to these aspects of the story that make the Clintons uncomfortable. The fact that Bill, I revealed in the book for the first time, had wanted to leave the marriage in 1989 for another woman, and that Hillary, as Betsy Wright, Bill Clinton's chief of staff in Arkansas, told me, had refused to give him a pass out of the marriage, as she put it. But almost at every turn in the reporting, I was really surprised and shocked at things I was learning. I was having breakfast one day with Donna Shalala, who had been handpicked by Hillary, her friend, to be Secretary of Health and Human Services. And Shalala said to me, well, I begged Bill Clinton not to appoint Hillary to the healthcare job because she really didn't have the necessary experience. She wasn't tested in Washington enough. And I was afraid it would be a disaster. And on top of which, if it turned out to be, he couldn't fire her. And so I talked also to Lloyd Benson, the Secretary of the Treasury, told me the same thing. So one of the revelations that got so much newspaper attention was that the great secret of healthcare was that those who had worked most closely in the presidency, in the cabinet, with Hillary Clinton in this attempt to get universal health care, had opposed her being appointed in the first place. And that their opposition was probably well-placed and well-thought. There's the whole matter of the staffing of the White House, which there's a section on during the transition between Bill Clinton's election and his taking office on January 20th, 1993. Well, Hillary really, with her friend Susan Thomasis, really staffed the White House. And it was a disaster, because there were few people with real Washington experience. And the extent to which Hillary and Bill Clinton, but especially Hillary Clinton, came into the White House with real animus and counterproductive contempt for the Washington establishment, as it were, was a terrible, terrible mistake. The Clintons weren't wrong about the nature of Washington altogether, or even a little bit, because by the time they had come to the White House, Washington was a truly dysfunctional place. That the government structure was broken. You know, if you really think about it, outside, and regardless of whether you agree with it or not, outside of NAFTA and one or two other pieces of legislation, you know, in the previous 25 years, there has been very little meaningful legislation in this country. There has been a cultural war at which the Clintons have also been at the center that has paralyzed our politics and our political system. And it probably became worse in almost every regard during the Clinton presidency, because there was such animus toward them, by the right, by the Republicans. And a lot of that, as it increased especially, came from a central fact, and it's perhaps Hillary Clinton's most effective claim in this campaign, and that is they beat the Republicans twice. You know, the Republicans thought they had a lock on the presidency, and Bill Clinton is the first president, Democrat, to be reelected president since Franklin Roosevelt. What the story of Hillary Clinton is a tale of perseverance. You see her particularly in the Arkansas years. You come to understand for the first time, perhaps, the importance of Bill Clinton's so-called other women, as far as Hillary is concerned. You know, here she is. She is married to someone we all knew to be probably the best, most dazzling, skilled politician of our time. But from the beginning, she, unlike the rest of us, knew that his sexual compulsions, as she termed them, would make him untenable as a political candidate if they became known and their extent became known and they weren't contained and their effect wasn't contained. So she, beginning very early in the marriage and in the gubernatorial years, became the person that tried to contain, cover up, deal with his sexual compulsions, largely through Betsy Wright, whom I spent dozens of hours with, who was Bill Clinton's chief of staff, put in the job by Hillary, and who also became the keeper of the secrets in the 1993 campaign. But the detectives hired, the lawyers hired to get statements from various women that they hadn't had affairs with Bill Clinton. It got so difficult that a suit was filed by Bill Clinton's political enemies in late 1980s, holding and to get jurisdiction, the suit was filed claiming that there was a slush fund in the governor's office that was used to entertain women, and inferred that five women had been entertained by the governor. And with this, Hillary had her own law firm hired to represent the five women, interrogate them, and get statements from them, affidavits that they had not, which they might well have not, had affairs with her husband. What was so significant is that she, Vince Foster, and Webb Hubbell, her law partners, interrogated the women themselves. Well, imagine at a certain point what that might do to emotionally to the wife of this amazingly talented political supernova. So this is an emotional story beginning in her childhood. Her father was a sour, unfulfilled man, a misanthrope, really, who verbally abused and humiliated and demeaned his wife. You don't have to be the Sopranos shrink to begin to start to see some parallels in the later life of Hillary Clinton. And it's not, as the reviews note, a psychobiography in the least that I've written, but some things leap off the page a little bit. And Hugh Rodham, her father, would be sitting at the dinner table with his family, and Hillary's friend, closest friend from childhood, Betsy Ebeling, who I spent many hours with, would be at the table, and her father, Hillary's father, was almost like a glove, would throw out a provocative topic for discussion on the table, and everybody would join in, and then her mother would try to get in, Hillary's mother would try to get a word in, and Hugh Rodham would say, well, who are you, Miss Smarty Pants? What do you know? Why do you think you can have a sensible something to say here? And Dorothy Rodham, Hillary's mother, had lived a really difficult life herself. She had been abandoned as an eight-year-old by her parents, who were teenagers when she was born. She and her sister had been sent to California to live with grandparents who used her pretty much as a domestic worker. She was sensitized, certainly to the point where very often when this would happen at the dinner table, she would get up and say, I can't take this anymore. And he would say, don't let the screen door hit you in the ass on the way out. Hugh Rodham had been a boot camp instructor during World War II at the Great Lakes Naval Air Station. He ran his house like boot camp. There were chores for the kids, schedules, orders barked from his recliner where he kind of presided. And even when he was older and approaching 80 and in the White House years, he was really disliked by many people in the White House, both the domestic staff and the Bill Clinton's staff, for the way he treated people. He was penurious. He was successful as a small entrepreneur. He taught his children the wisdom of thrift, hard work. And Hillary responded to this aura by trying to win his approval, as she put it in her own autobiography. And there are great hints in Hillary's autobiography around the big holes that you can drive a truck through of things that really happened. And for instance, she says, my father wasn't one to spare the rod, and he was especially tough on my brothers. raising the question of how severely she had been beaten by her father. But she never addresses it. And, of course, kids were brought up different, too, at that time. And but he had an awful lot of depression in his family. He, when Hillary was an infant, his parents had called him back to Scranton, Pennsylvania. His brother, who had been the great hope of the family, a doctor, had a serious depression. They wanted Hillary's father to come home and help them with it. When he got there, his brother was hanging from the rafters, and he cut him down, still alive, and he brought him back to Chicago to live with Hillary, then an infant, and Dorothy, his wife, and eventually his brother descended into alcoholism and died in a fire that he had started with a cigarette. And he joined no community organizations. He had been an athlete at Penn State, but he also was great at exaggerating things. Some would say a family trait, and talked and said that his career prospects as a pro football player had been ended by a knee injury at Penn State. Except he had really been a third string tight end at Penn State. Because I went back and found the school newspaper for the period. He had said that he had had a football scholarship. Well, there were no football scholarships at the time. No, there were some athletic scholarships, so it's possible that he had that. But Hillary was always trying to please him. She would bring home all A's and a B, and he would say, well, what happened? Why'd you get the B? But he also had a belief that the fact that Hillary was a girl should not keep her from doing anything that any boy could do. And he taught her to play baseball, pitched her a softball, taught her to play pinochle, helped her with her homework. And again, this notion of family Hillary will come to her two brothers' defense, as she often did in the White House years, such as the there are some funny aspects to the tale when they decided to corner the hazelnut market in Soviet Georgia, persisted until finally the national security advisor to the president said, listen, you're getting into some big trouble here. It was a rough family to grow up in. She never thought she had adequate clothing. He wouldn't give her enough money for clothes. She wrote a letter to her youth minister about how embarrassed she felt about the gown that she had for the prom. But a great story I was told about the prom. She didn't have a date for the senior prom, and her friend Betsy Ebeling, who told me the story, said, well, I'm going to ask my friend, and she told me his name, to take you to the prom. So this kid came and picked her up one night to sort of have a tryout date. He said, have you ever been on a skateboard? And Hillary said yes. And she was a pretty good athlete, actually. So he said, let's go over to the hill at the hospital. And they drove over there. He said, why don't you try the hill here? Hillary got on the skateboard and went down the hill and didn't wipe out. He took her to the prom. One of the interesting things about Hillary Clinton is she had far more real life experience than Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton is really an intellectual who has operated by received wisdom and reading and studying, and talking to people. Hillary's somebody who all her life has done things. babysat for migrant workers' children. She worked in a factory in Alaska sliming fish, salmon, with a spoon, taking their guts out during one summer of college. She played Martha in a production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. She certainly had more real relationships with men, meaningful relationships, than Bill had had with women at the time that they met. And religion, really always where she would go back to. She had been raised in the Methodist Church, and when she was in high school, there came to Park Ridge, Illinois, to her Methodist church, a young youth minister who arrived in a red Chevy Impala convertible, not just with the Gospels, but also with Bob Dylan's records and copies of Picasso's pictures, including the Tableau of Guernica, the great tableau of the agony of the Spanish Civil War, studies and books by 20th century theologians like Bierenhofer and Reinhold Niebuhr, who really believed that the role of the Christian was essentially had to have a political component with a spiritual aspect, and that the principles of the Gospels and the Gospels of Christ had to be translated into political action in terms of Christ's message of community, helping neighbors. And this was particularly resonant to Hillary, who already had been very attracted to John Wesley's basic do-gooding almost notion of do all the good you can, whenever you can, wherever you can, at all times you can. And she has said, that's why I feel so comfortable in this church. And she became extremely close to this youth minister. He took these young people to hear Martin Luther King preach. She met Martin Luther King when she was in her mid-teens, when he took her downtown. Up till that point, until Don Jones, this youth minister, came, she had been a Goldwater girl. She had campaigned. In fact, during the Goldwater's 64 campaign, she had gone to the projects, these dangerous projects in the south side of Chicago, and tried to learn if residents there were really registered to vote, and if they were the same people who were registered, obviously part of an effort to really keep black people from voting. But King's visit had enormous effect on her, and like many conservative, traditional young people from the Midwest during the 60s, through the turmoil of Vietnam, King's assassination, and as she became a student leader at Wellesley, she moved away from that background and became a nationally recognized student leader. What I'm trying to get at, and I want to spend some time answering your questions, is that the life of Hillary Clinton is not something that is to be judged on the basis of one aspect or another, that many people, I'm sure, will read this book. The idea is that you take your own values, and when you know who this person is and how she has lived her life and what it has been, then you can make some judgments about her as a person, as a candidate. I'd suggest that had we known and had real biography about George Bush in the year 2000, he wouldn't be president today. There's actually no doubt about it in my mind. There really isn't. And yet we had misinformation and disinformation, and the hints were there, and particularly in some of the work that had been done back in Texas by some reporters, and we chose largely to ignore it. In the case of Hillary Clinton, we need to know who this person is, who we may vote for, we may vote against, who may be the next president, but to know who she is, We need to know her life. We need to know the life as she's lived it. And as those who have seen her living it have described it. And that's what I've tried to do here through 7 years of reporting and in writing. And I really, buy the book. You don't like it? I'll give you my email. I'll give you your money back. So, not because I'm going to make a lot of money off you. I mean, I'm not going to earn airfare here. The idea is I want people to read this book, and people ought to know about this person and the remarkable life she has led. And it is a tale of kind of spectacular ups and terrible, terrible free fall at various times. And when you see it all linked together, you begin. I had a wonderful experience on the plane the other day. A guy came up to me and said, you know, my wife has hated Hillary Clinton, and she read your book, and she said, you know, I'm still not going to vote for her, but I understand her, I think. And I, you know, that's all you can hope for as an author. But I think that you will understand or begin to understand this woman. And it's meant to be fun to read. And thank you for being here. And soon we'll all be back in front of the television watching a ball game.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fodum. We have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for Richard Russo, Mary Carwile, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on October 15th, 2007.